Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. My name is Christopher Cotter. David Robertson, who is normally with me every week, is not here. So you've just got me. Consequently, I am not in one of Edinburgh's many hostelries. I'm not drinking beer. I've actually just drunk a cup of tea, and I'm in my living room. Fancy that. We were thinking that this was going to be our final podcast before our summer break. But what we wanted to do was put out a roundtable discussion that we recorded at the BSA Sociology of Religion Conference back in April, because we thought if we left that until September, it wouldn't be fair on all the fantastic people who contributed to it. It wouldn't be fair on you guys to not hear it. And it would give us another week to make sure that the final episode is absolutely top-notch. So what you've got here is a roundtable discussion on material religion. And we'll all introduce ourselves now, so just take it away, guys. Thank you. We are in Durham, in the Samuel Smith's pub, the Swan and Three Cygnets.
Swan and Three Cygnets, yes.
And we have been attending the British Sociological Association's Sociology of Religion Study Group Conference on Material Religion.
That's SOCREL for short.
Yes, so SOCREL from now on, please. And so that's what we're going to be talking about, material religion. Broadly, is it useful, is it not, what we took from the conference. I am Christopher Cotter at Lancaster University. I'm not going to talk too much about what I'm doing, except I'm the non-religion guy. To my left is
David Wilson.
Religious studies project regular.
Yeah, it's fine. Well, I suppose those listeners will probably be fed up hearing my name. So my beer too.
George Ioannidis, PhD student at the University of Sydney, Australia. PhD on material religion, interlinked with philosophical and cultural studies understandings of materiality.
I'm Rachel Hanneman at the University of Kent at Canterbury, and I'm exploring the role of the body in processes of religious transmission, focusing on all-girls Catholic schools.
And, well, if you're the listeners will know my voice, I'm sure. I'm David Robertson, the Religious Studies Project regular host. Where do we start, Chris?
Well, before we kick this off, I just said that I've been to an entire conference on material religion and heard a lot of interesting papers, but I'm still not entirely sure what material religion is, more than simply looking at some stuff, looking at things and stuff. Was that what
Marion? Marion Bowman defined it in the first plenary as stuff about things and things about stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, did anyone else get anything more than that sort of basic? Attention to things.
I suppose my sense of it was just that looking at material representations of religion, artifacts of one sort or another, asking how are religious traditions represented materially, just helps to bring out new aspects of traditions that we might not otherwise notice. And I don't know that it's a particularly sophisticated tool beyond that, but that's still a useful exercise. So in a sense, you're applying one particular definition of how religion can manifest and how traditions maintain themselves and the spaces that people use and how they represent cosmologies in those spaces and so on. So there's a lot that thinking about the material representations of religion can actually bring out that you might not notice otherwise. That has been quite productive, and there has been a fair bit of scholarship doing that in recent years.
I certainly found that in my paper. I mean, it was essentially just an overview of work which I'd presented before, but by taking that one particular lens and looking at, through the material religion lens, if you will, it did kind of reveal a few aspects of particularly the economic side of it, which I'd just never really considered before. And so that was quite enlightening.
I suppose that's one way you can use it. You look at material things that are relevant to religious practitioners, but that lets you take your examination of their lives out of arenas that you would normally look at as sacred or religious, and look at how they might be practicing or still doing things in other areas of life as well.
I found it useful as well in talking to my participants who are generally younger. It's a secondary school. It's a good way to have them walk me through their process of meaning making, to look at something physical and tactile and ask what that means to them or why they chose to arrange something or experience something in a certain way.
It seems as if material religion, in a sense, is the study of religion trying to catch up with other developments that have occurred in other fields of academia, valorizing much more notions of embodiment and placement, ecology, materializing or rematerializing what some have called the really intense kind of neo-Cartesian epistemologies undergirding a lot of notions of belief versus practice, mind versus body binaries that maybe not as much, but that used to extensively permeate the discipline.
Just going sort of completely on a tangent, perhaps, but when I was interviewing Peter Collins earlier, and it was a point that I had noticed, but I hadn't really brought explicitly to my mind, is that the whole conference seemed to be taking material religion at a very sort of small object level. Like, nothing was dealing with I didn't hear any papers dealing with the environment, with spaces, with buildings. Mm-hmm. It was all sort of amulets and statues and things like that that people were talking about.
Well, I think there can't be a practical reason for that sometimes. So just thinking about one of the traditions I've looked at, Venki shamanism. In traditional shamanism, there has been a lot of attention paid to costume and equipment like drums and things that shamans use. But there is one really interesting article from the 60s that came out with Toronto University Press. I think Kamisimov produced it. And he's an article here on the shaman's tent.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost looking at the tent as a kind of building within which the shaman gives his or her performances. And the point he's making is that the inside of these things used to be covered in all sorts of mythological and cosmological representations that were almost could be read as stories, almost like going into a church with stained glass windows.
Mm.
But of course, things like shaman's tents don't survive as easily as jackets and rustles and drums and things do, because they're smaller and they tend to survive and end up in museums, whereas a complete tent just won't very easily. So the bigger the scale that you're looking at physically, the harder it perhaps comes in some traditions actually to get examples of what would give you that sort of opening.
I believe there was one panel on architecture and Christianity.
Just missed that one.
There was a theme throughout sort of whether a space that's once been made sacred maintains sacrality. So if a church is converted to something else, or if the priest leaves the vestry and questions like that.
I suppose just building off what you were saying there, David, with smaller objects it's much easier to infer intentionality. If someone's carrying around something or wearing something, then there's a clear connection there, whereas someone in a building, or people in a space, it's difficult to know what level of engagement they're having there. Whereas it's a much more definite intentionality.
Using things. A focus on small objects, if you will, it works really well with what goes on in the sociology of religion, and particularly recent manifestations of it, such as vernacular religion, everyday religion, lived religion, all these words that are appended to it. It seems to be a move towards this notion of religion on the ground and how people manifest their religiosities through the things around them. And most usually, on an everyday scale, that's just the objects that they encounter. And it might have been that such a focus was overrepresented because it's a sociology of religion conference.
Yes.
Yeah. There are works, was it the Bloomsbury Stand had a book, Sacred and the City. There are, notions of spatialization and religion try and deal with kind of, a larger focus than the object.
Mm. It may be that the just to build on what you were saying there, that the smallness and often by extension the everydayness of these objects underlines that the approach is meant to be a change from the traditional approach of institutions and churches and large scale ceremonies. That this is more it helps to shift the focus onto the everyday, the vernacular, the
and also it gives you access to just how variable one tradition can be. You start looking at individual practices, individual practices within that. And it's also often easier to perceive the relationship that someone has with a small object. Mm-hmm. It's less obvious sometimes when somebody walks into a big civic space whether their behaviour is changing at all. You're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Are they doing anything different? And if so, what means? That could be a lot harder to pin down.
I do, though, think it's useful to look at bigger spaces like that because their meaning is much more communally constructed. So as opposed to looking at a smaller object and saying, what meaning has this for the individual? For the personal, you can look at an individual's response to a communally constructed meaning.
And actually, I was at a conference in Chicago in November, which was looking at exactly this, the ways in which religions change when they are conducted in very dense urban environments. Do they become something different because of the setting? Those relationships are a lot harder to articulate.
And I think certainly the London itself does play a large role in the religious lives of the community that I work with in London. Very obvious.
To take things back a bit, sorry, I push things into a built environment kind of thing, back to the whole material religion approach, back to what it gives to religious studies. I think, David, you kick us off with your belief comment.
Yeah, well, I mean, what George was saying earlier, I think there's... I mean, we can have our specific criticisms of the way that it's handled, the material religion approach has been handled in this particular conference. But I think to go back to sort of what the intention of it was and what its potential utility for the discipline is, I agree with George that it can help shift this focus onto the personal and the specific and the everyday. But I think another quite important issue is that it is an attempt to avoid talking about belief. And actually, this kind of echoes what you were saying about the neo-Cartesian dualities. This sort of idea that we have beliefs, which are different from our actions, and specifically the. I mean, we can talk more about belief later, but the idea of sort of that we hold prepositional beliefs, which are things that we say, I believe this, and that they drive our actions, is a very problematic one, and a lot of people have criticised that. And I think material religion is a part of a broader attempt to avoid using the term at all, to try and describe the phenomena and the utility that people put religion to without talking about these reified beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder. Oh, sorry. Nope. I wonder if also the use of those material things as mediator might involve a reluctance to engage with the larger ideas of the divine on the part of the individual using them. So it's much easier to focus on something small and everyday than it is to daily engage with that broad and complex concept.
It's this idea of the mediating. I kind of have a problem with that because that is assuming the sui generis divine kind of idea. And I wonder actually if I kind of agree with you. I don't know if people are engaging with the divine on an everyday thing, but I think they are engaging with that little object or whatever the thing is that we're talking about.
No, it's this notion of religion as media, as mediation, and mediatization is also this other kind of subset of works going on in the larger picture of material religion. But I was wondering, it's a lot of work on digital religion, if you will, and online manifestations of religiosities have also been placed within the remit of material religion. But there seems to be a dilemma there because, yes, I mean, there are material agents at work, you know, when persons
log on
computers and iPads and iPhones and all that kind of stuff, but is it immaterial? How can we?
Yeah.
How does one grapple with this material and immaterial binary that that everyone kind of constantly grapples with when talking about material religion?
I would say if there is a demonstrably immaterial realm, then it's the online realm, surely. That's one reality that we all interact with all the time, which it's definitely not there in any physical sense.
But then we get
very real. Yeah.
I don't know if it always helps to theorise it too much. It's simply that by thinking in terms of a material and non-material distinction, you are just imposing, projecting a dividing line onto whichever religious tradition you're looking at. And it just helps to bring things to the surface. So that if I think in terms of material religion, I notice these things in this tradition. Yeah. Then that implies its opposite. So if I think in terms of the immaterial in this tradition, what else do I notice by thinking in those terms? And that, you're doing both of those. It's not necessarily intensive theoretical exercise, but it can, as a practical matter, still help you notice things that you might otherwise miss. Just because you're applying that kind of template or that boundary between these two things. A year on, you might apply some other boundary, some other distinction to the same tradition, and then start noticing other things.
Mm-hmm. In saying that, are we re-inscribing a boundary or binary between theory and practice then?
That too, yes.
And we're also creating a boundary between material and immaterial.
So
in some ways it actually reinforces that.
Because what we were saying earlier was that you can end up broadening the material approach so it includes virtual world, words, sounds, smells.
But then of course once something becomes everything it means nothing at all.
So
it is always helpful, I think, to bear in mind the opposite. Because as soon as you come out of the state of light, all religion is material religion. Actually, the materiality of religion becomes irrelevant because it's not anything particular. You're just throwing it into one category, and it means it's no use to anything.
Could it be because there's confusion in this use of the term material and its various variants, matter, material, materiality, materialism, materialization? Do we need more rigor in our particular employments?
That's something I always argue for, because unless you're actually thoughtful and sharing about the definitions that you're using, rather than just jumping in and using a term, then you may not notice yourself what's coming out of that exercise. And also other scholars listening to you might completely miss what you're actually saying. So you've got to give a definition of your term, I think, always at the very beginning. And that's not to make the claim that your definition is the right one. It's just the one you're using for a particular purpose, or to see what happens by applying it.
Absolutely.
As an experiment.
Because I think to go back to auditory culture and gestures and things of that nature, it's also important to consider what the participants consider. So although in, you know, my definition of material religion, a gesture or someone did a presentation about sound calling forth the Ark of the Covenant, and then the participants experiencing that as a real physical presence. And so I think that's where some difficulty arises, that if something that I might not consider material myself is considered material by the people participating in the ritual.
I think that's why it's important to be clear what we mean in terms of it.
Yeah.
Because you can have three scholars will stand up and give a paper using exactly the same term, and they will mean three different things about it.
Absolutely.
But you don't realise that. You've listened to them and actually started picking apart what they're coming up with. And actually, if they had all used exactly the same definition, you could then have had a direct conversation between them and so disagree with each other. Mm-hmm. They're getting engaged debate. So as long as they're using different definitions, they can always talk and ask each other.
Yeah. And that's the worst edited volumes that you read sometimes. Yes. In every chapter is using a different... You know, think if you're going to be an editor, at least get people to be consistent in their terms.
Yeah. So far as you can.
Yeah. Mm. Or be explicit when they're not.
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't know, there's a lot of academics just don't do this exercise of, you know, being clear about the definitions. Maybe it's just too boring for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, two points coming from that. One is directly related to, well, if people, if say believers, you know, feel things as, you know, material things in the world, you know, do we treat it as physical materiality? And I was discussing, like, I can't remember with whom last night, but about even, you know, dreams and our thoughts and everything. Every thought that we have is embodied in some way, so you can end up thinking about the mental aspect, you know. Even if you're in a virtual world, like spinning the virtual mandala, you're still virtually interacting with material objects, which aren't...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what we were saying earlier on about if you widen the pie of what you count as material so far, then ultimately it becomes an exercise in futility if you say anything's material.
But there are very different, even straightforward senses of what materiality is about, because, you know, there's a sense of materiality that is entangled with significance rather than physicality. You know, is this a material concern? Can mean, is this one that matters? And then it's nothing to do with physical or unphysical. You're taking a completely different angle and division word in that sense.
Yeah, it seems as if what we're saying is that material religion does have some value and does have can bring about some really, really interesting work, as long as scholars employ it with much more rigour than we've seen of late.
And to take this sort of Timothy Fitzgerald line, well, we don't need to call that material religion. It's a material approach to standard religious studies. Like, I mean, it's not really a distinct... It's a method.
Well, it's a methodology that's concerned with, you know, issues of materiality of one sort or another.
Well, that goes back to what I was saying earlier.
It's not the religion that's material or non-material. It's
to do with the approach.
We're examining it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, I mean, a lot of actually what we've seen at the conference has been... It's more about languages a lot of the time. It's quite often they'll show you an object and then the rest of the talk is deconstructing how insiders read the language of that object. Or like the clothes today, when you have the symbols and this means certain thing, and then in the insider group it means something different. A lot of the time it's actually language. And I have a bit of an issue with that because I'm not sure whether... I don't think a language is material.
It's
something which happens between... It's a way of... conceptualizing something between different parties.
I mean, this is quite fascinating because this current material turn that we're seeing in so many academic fora was precipitated by rejection of what some scholars have called linguisticisms, the linguistic turn.
You mean like sort of post-Wittgenstein kind of philosophy.
Well, post-structuralists, and this notion that language has been granted too much power, to quote Karen Barad, who's a former scholar in this wider material juncture within the academy, you could say. And so bringing in notions of the material and materiality to the study of religion, I kind of feel like scholars ignore or forget the wider intellectual and genealogical history of the notion of materiality and the material.
which is this larger genealogy? Can you unpack that for us?
Well,
I suppose like briefly, in just that sense that discourse analysis of religion perhaps became a bit too dominant. Everything is seen in terms of what it signifies, this language and conversation that's going on.
But this is exactly what I'm saying. A lot of the papers that we've seen have done just that.
They have done exactly that.
They've done exactly been examining the discourses that evolved around the imagery or symbolism of particular objects.
And of course, well, maybe that teaches us then that discourse analysis, or the understanding of religion as a conversation, deserves to be significant. Because if we tried to bring in this concept of materiality as a way of countering that emphasis, and then find naturally all that happens, we end up back in the same place.
Well,
maybe there's a good reason for it.
It's one of those things where you can only know about someone's intentionality relating to an object. You can only know what someone's interpretation of a practice is by hearing it.
Right.
Or interpreting it through language. So even if you are praying, you're just like, I'm just entirely doing practice, you still have to put that practice into discourse, which then brings you back to the same.
Because a lot of physical items in religious traditions, they do serve a kind of mnemonic function. You know, they're a reminder of a conversation that is ongoing.
And that's one of the etymologies of the word, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't remember which one. Is it religare?
I think they are more than just that, though, because surely if they were just reminders of the conversation, then...
Oh, they can be much more than that, yes.
So I think there is still relevance. Perhaps if we keep bringing it around to language, we need to work on the way that we're approaching these objects, but I think there is somewhat more than just...
Yeah,
I suppose the danger in always bringing it back into language or conversation is that that can overlook the significance of something for a religious practitioner. You know, it's not just a conversation involved in this, can be something that is overwhelming for its ultimate significance goes beyond language.
But are we disembodying language in speaking this way about it? Isn't language material sometimes? I know that might be a really kind of radical.
People would say it's very material because you're using a an almost physical energy, and some sounds can hit you if they're strong enough or deep enough.
But then we're back to that.
It could even be a fundamental thing to do with the way that we research is we have to express things in language to disseminate, you know, to share knowledge, and maybe just to bring in the sort of current trendy cognitive science. Like, that's, is that the only maybe method that's there that manages to get at experiences which are happening internally, which are not being mediated through language? Are there other methodologies out there which avoid having to get at a person's experience through their language?
One of the major aspects of what I'm researching involves the fact that I was raised Catholic and am no longer practicing Catholic. And so this idea of material objects and then also of embodied practices has a lot of significance, because being in those Catholic spaces, I sometimes find myself unconsciously reverting to, so I several times have walked into the chapel and anointed myself with holy water, which is not an object or an embodied practice that is part of my current, but it, so it, that's why I think it's something more, because it's not part of a discourse that's currently a part of my life. It's a different, more visceral, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and this is how to access that, particularly in, like, you know, you have that intuitive sense, and we all probably have an intuitive sense that, you know, someone is experiencing something that they're not verbalizing, that they're not conscious of, but how do you access that as a researcher without putting it into...
And also, how do you access things that a practitioner themselves might not want to articulate if you're exploiting them? Because if you then force someone to articulate something they don't feel is appropriate for the verbal articulation, how are you actually getting to what it is that's going on there?
In fact, somebody was talking about that, wasn't there? There was a paper about, was it the Amish women?
Yes.
Did anybody else see that? She was saying that they didn't articulate any broader systems. It was like they did a certain thing because they were ill, and that was as much as they would say, and she had no access to it at all. But she attempted to gain that access through the material expressions of them shopping at Kmart or whatever it was. I can't remember.
Somebody has been referenced an awful lot during this conversation. All of us have referenced somebody.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us somebody that had been referenced.
No,
just
that.
Somebody's been very busy.
Yeah.
I thought about getting out my booklet so we had access to everybody's names with their presentations.
Yeah. But on a similar note, Abby Day's presentation yesterday was about your current research, which is with sort of older women born in like the 20s and 30s in churches, and she was talking about how she had to become a member of the church community and start attending all these events, and within about 3 or 4 weeks she started to know who was a stranger, started to get added to the flower rota and things like that without really ever talking about it. She talks a lot about the whole tea rota thing, like we always talk about the old women doing the teas and all that sort of, but that's all sort of a material expression of a sort of very, well, quote, traditional, unquote, form of Christianity, which isn't vocalized, it isn't talked about, and you can only get access to that through sort of sustained ethnographic fieldwork and through participating and dealing with the same objects and that sort of thing. And then you still come to the same problem of then you have to go to a conference and present it and talk about it.
And I suppose that is, that learned reading, to go back to the linguistic, of those cultural things isn't something that you can instantly transmit.
Mm.
Hence the return to discourse.
Like what you were saying yesterday, David, about like the news media being an appropriate medium for religion to engage with, it doesn't lend itself to the wrong sort of materiality.
Ties back though to what I was saying about belief. Sorry to harp on it,
but
again, it's something which is weighing heavy on my mind. Is it the case that for Abby Day, it was she was gaining the research, she was becoming an insider, but for an ordinary person who wasn't an academic, it would be the same process by which they would be inculcated into the community. But is it that you do this and you slowly gain the belief, or is it that it's this manipulation of material things, this involvement in circles of people, is that what it is? Do we need to posit something more? Is it simply using these objects in the context that other people are using them, which ascribe a certain meaning, a certain set of symbolic languages that are interchanging between the group? A potential of material religion is to try and look at it from that sort of radically de-enchanted, if you like, where we don't have... Because, it's got to be, we're talking about objects, the point of it is to be the objective world, not the subjective world. There's lots of that in religious studies, too much of that perhaps, I think is what Morgan's trying to suggest. Well, I've floored them.
In a good way.
There's a question at least to be asked as to whether the objectification. This thinking in terms of things, this reification is actually a good way to be looking at religion. I mean, that's a question that has to be asked, at least, I think.
Is it a suitable site for religion? Can we embody religion in this kind of discourse?
I think it's also interesting. We've heard a lot of papers at this conference that try to flip notions of agency onto the material itself, away from human intentionality. A lot of work in material religion, a lot of valuable work, I think, tries to speak of notions of relationality between human object, human non-human kind of relationships and communication.
Yes, I mean, there are certain religious traditions that will be things that way of looking at them does bring it very effectively. I mean, I'm thinking again in terms of mediumistic or spirit communication traditions, shamanic traditions, where non-human but as alive entities are communicated with. Also physical objects like stones, for example, some will be significant, but others felt to be in one terminology, some element of spirit present. But it's that presence that gives that thing its significance. Other stones might just be stones, but there are certain stones that are more than just stones, and you are in relationship with them.
Well, you're paraphrasing Graham Harvey there, I think.
Absolutely.
Which is great, because he is another scholar who does this exact thing that I'm talking about trying to avoid talking about beliefs. He won't ascribe beliefs anymore. As he puts it, the old animism was that it was ascribing a naive belief that things had spirits living in them. Now he says that's not the correct way to understand an animist worldview. Nowadays he defines it as animism is a set of etiquettes for relationships with other beings, some of whom are not human.
Other persons and humans.
Persons, yes, that's right. Some of whom are not humans.
Yes, it's a notion of etiquette of a world full of personhoods.
Which is something he's developed out of his examination of taboos, because taboo is not about forbidden things, it's more about knowing how to behave towards one connector.
Yeah. So, yes, the shoes on the table is taboo, but on the floor that's perfectly appropriate. They're not forbidden.
I think it might just be a case of trying to think of corresponding ways to think through all these questions. Perhaps it's the case that this talking about belief hasn't subsided. It's just stepped aside for this current moment in our discipline, and that once this kind of massive flurry of work, if it will wane or if it won't, maybe then will come back.
Perhaps it is just that it's sort of right. Let's see if we can make this work without talking about it. If it works, it'll probably carry on as a tradition. And if it doesn't, then at least we'll have found out.
I think it's it's quite new. Although the questions are not new. I mean, it's a rematerialization. It's not. I mean, there's such a long history of scholars and writers thinking through the relationship between religion, matter, and materiality. There's something quite idiosyncratic about what's happening in recent years. It's a rematerialization, so not rather than a materialization.
That's interesting. So, what religious studies developed out of linguistics, that's where the discipline to some extent came from. There's always been a sort of fundamental sense of being at home in terms of thinking, like having discussions, dialogues, conversations.
And they're being influenced by this other work that's at play.
It may just be a testing of that familiarity to see if there are other things that will help.
Okay.
And they may or may not. Maybe we're just at a point where that experiment is still being carried out and the results aren't in yet.
I guess we're sort of looking for, you know, a sort of optimistic conclusion to the discussion. You know, what does the future hold? I think I'd be right in saying that, whether from this conference or from our wider research, that we're all quite now more aware of the material aspects of our own research and much more likely in future to notice material aspects that we might not have before. But I guess, does anyone have any sort of burning sort of positives that we, or, well, burning points that we haven't made yet that you would like to?
Yeah, not that I haven't made several times already. I think it's right. It's part of a broader trend, I think, which is questioning this idea of belief, and which I think is a positive step away from the Protestant bias the Protestant genealogy of the discipline. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think with this and with what some other people are doing, then we could end up in quite an interesting place.
I know within the work that I do, looking at spiritualism and mediumship and shamanic traditions, it's always been something I've been aware of, that belief doesn't really figure very much in the dialogues in those traditions.
Yeah.
And to the extent that belief exists, it's only there in a more general sense of the things that people trust in as real.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not the same as belief in terms of a set of mental beliefs that you subscribe to.
Yeah, exactly.
You're thinking more in terms of a worldview that people build up bit by bit, either through the society that they're born into, the practices they participate in, and then bit by bit, they build up a worldview that connects very closely with their own personal experience.
I think we need to take that and start talking about knowledge rather than belief, because we've made this whole separation between them, and it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and also that whole process of learning and getting beyond yourself. And what I mean by that is, accepting and trusting in the reality of a material world that is beyond ourselves.
Yeah.
That is a step that every human being has to make at some point in order to function socially at all.
Yeah.
Religion comes out of that process.
I've been very good and haven't mentioned non-religion at all. What the material approach does is that there were some papers at this conference, and I've seen some others. We'll say secular instead of non-religious, but it allows a space for. You can see the same practices and the same relationships to objects happening, be it people in religious communities, people out with religious communities, people who disavow any religious commitment. But you can see the same use of space, the same investment in certain objects, and it allows a bridge to sort of cross that line where you say, well, this group are religious and this group aren't. If you look at the way people are engaging with the material environment around them, so rather than it being a material religion approach, it's generally a material approach, can allow you to navigate that those fuzzy waters in between the two.
If we start talking in terms of different traditions whereby people acquire socially useful knowledge, we all talk about religion at all.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what needs to happen.
Because you could include in that the Western scientific tradition.
Indeed.
Final thoughts.
I suppose I think that the study of material culture is useful across most social interactions, and religion's just one of those. And I think that's good.
That's good.
I mean, as a final point, just playing on the impressions that we've got from this conference that have brought us all here the last few days, and this notion of trying to bring some kind of you know, theoretical, methodological, conceptual rigor back into the questions that we are asking in the vein of this current trend in our discipline. Maybe it behooves scholars to look at the way in which other disciplines are dealing with the same kind of questions of matter, materiality, materialism, and as everyone's saying, and then to look at religion as merely just one of what was one of a social human, non-human assemblage of relationalities. I'll leave it there.
Articulated that so much more elegant.
Boom. So you've just been listening to the roundtable discussion that we recorded in Durham. So I hope you very much enjoyed that, and I hope that you will come back next week for our final podcast. I just wanted to mention that the Religious Studies Project is presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and we are very grateful for their support. Our Facebook following is continuing to go up. You can like us on Facebook there, follow us on Twitter, you can download the podcasts and subscribe through iTunes or through email and things like that. And remember about our Amazon links over the summer if you're buying all sorts of DVDs or barbecue equipment or whatever. All that remains for me to say, as per usual, thanks for listening.